Oh, I am on. That's amazing. It's really nice to be here. Thank you very much for your welcome, Chris. And I am very much looking forward to our time together and to us talking about some very important things. Of course, the title presupposes something quite significant. It presupposes that every single one of us in this room is human. What makes us human? Rather than what makes me human, I'm assuming that the very fact that you are all here and alive and interested and alert and raring to go, all these things presuppose that you are in fact human. Now, you may think that's a very odd place to start, but actually, what I think highlights the importance of this very question is the fact that over history, in actually even within living memory, it may well be the case that some, if not many of us, have not been regarded as human. Maybe slightly less than human, might be subhuman, might be unhuman. So I wonder if, as we start, we can just think about why this is an important question, why it is in fact perhaps a dangerous question. Maybe dangerous politically, maybe dangerous culturally. So just, I don't know, chat to your neighbour, just think about that and then shout out some thoughts in a moment. So what makes this an important question, even a dangerous question? Does that make sense? Okay. Any thoughts? There was talking. Whether that indicates thoughts is hard to say at this stage. Yes. Okay, so let's take the healthcare and treatment issue. So, the unborn, yep. And we could equally add the frail and senior. So the beginnings and ends of life is a very important area of this. So where being human begins or ends, or whether or not it does at all, is actually not just dangerous, it's actually life-threatening. Okay, good. Yeah. Right. Okay, sort of social strata, social, yeah. Should we call it division? Okay. Status. Yep, good. Now, you might think, what's that got to do with being human? I mean, people wouldn't necessarily think sort of lower class are less human, are they? But then actually, when that gets factored into some decision-making, we might come back to that, particularly if you start thinking statistically and at a global level, and the value of a life is the value of a Western life greater than the value of an African life. And that has sort of hidden subtleties, hidden implications about humanness. So, yeah, good. Anything else? Yes. Right. So, so going back, it's is there any distinction, and what actually does a human? What does it mean to be human? So, okay, we assume we're all human, but what actually does that entail? We want to think about that as well. Good. Yeah. So, animals. Okay. Just for shorthand. Yep. Yep. Human rights. Yes. I mean, I might sort of put that up here. Because in some ways, that entails... If there is such a thing as human rights, then who is human will determine who has access to those rights or should. But once you've made that decision, then you would assume those rights should be equally enjoyed. Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. Genetics. Do you want to say more about genetics? No. I feel the same way, actually, brother. So are you touching on the issue of, sort of kind of identity and individuality and whether we are just the product of our chemicals, or are you thinking something else?
I was just thinking on the definition. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And now you see the interesting thing about that. Now, I am definitely not a scientist, as will be very clear as the day goes on, if it isn't already clear. I'm a classicist, so I only deal with really old, dead things. People, as well. Isn't it interesting that I think I'm right in saying that the genetic makeup of the higher mammals, the apes, is about 95-98% the same as ours. All right, so there's sort of a difference of maybe 2-3%. Is that a significant enough gap to entail a major distinction of identity, of being, of essence? But then, of course, you see the fun thing about looking at it that way is we share 50% of the genetic makeup of a banana. Bet you didn't know that. If you learn one thing today, it's that. You share 50% of your makeup with a banana. Be very careful what you eat, I think is the lesson of that. So there's a limit to how far you can push that issue. Should you cut bananas in half and say, right, half of them should have human rights? I mean, something is stupid, isn't it? But it raises an interesting problem. But particularly, I think this relates to the natural world animal distinction. Yeah, good. Any more on why this is dangerous? I mean, I think we're touching on a lot of the things. Yes, sorry. So observing, as the person observing out, or... Mm-hmm. Right. And I think one of the books I really enjoyed reading is out of print. Donald Mackay wrote a book in, I think it was about 1970, with IVP. You can still pick it up on Amazon or BookBrain or whatever, called The Clockwork Image. It's a great book and actually hasn't dated. He was the one who coined this wonderful phrase, nothing buttery. And basically, he was a neuroscientist, I think. He was head of a psychology department. I can't remember which university, but he also did a lot of sort of the science philosophy overlap with issues of neurology and the brain. But he said one of the big problems with science is that it will make, you know, the essence of science, as I understand it, is you know, you draw conclusions on the basis of compiled evidence about processes, about the sort of hows of things that happen. The mistake is to then say, what I've seen and how I've described this event is nothing, there's nothing else to say about it. So that this is nothing but a chemical process. The question is it possible for something to be described in scientific terms and be a number of other things at the same time? So he basically pointed out this reductionism that happens all the time. And it's not just in science. I mean, you see this in politics, you see this in ethics, you see this in some of the most heated debates these days on issues of sexuality and gender, as well as many other things, that it's about, you know, this is nothing but a dot, dot, dot. And Donald Mackay brilliantly calls us out on that and says that's just nothing buttery. Whereas actually, it could be, yes, it is that, and a whole load of other things. Which is kind of the thing you're getting at, I think. Yeah. Good. Yes. Ooh. It's interesting. It's taken us 25 minutes to get some theology in. Who do you think you all are? Anyway, image of God. Now, we're going to have to spend a bit of time thinking about that, as I hope you're pleased to hear. And what that means is a whole can of lots of worms, but we will talk about it, yes.
As the urge to worship, I mean, it's inbuilt in him, mm-hmm. to worship, mm-hmm. Even if it's not true God.
Yep.
It's inherent, it's
that's right. There is this innate sense that there is a higher being, there is something beyond, that the material, the visible, the tangible, is not the totality of stuff, that there's something beyond. And that's the great C.S. Lewis argument in Mere Christianity, isn't it? That, you know, just as we hunger for something because presupposing the existence of food, whether or not we find food, the fact that we are hungry for it shows that it must exist. In the same way, we hunger for God. Whether or not we find God presupposes that there is one. So yes, there is this innate thing, and anthropologists will agree, the world over, doesn't matter what culture you're examining, we will worship, even in the secular West. Yep, yes. Yes. So the whole issue of morality and conscience, and you see, of course, that is quite a dangerous topic these days. Even to talk about ethics and morality in public life can get you shot down. And yet, isn't it interesting how so often, whether it's about going into Iraq or bombing ISIS or whatever, isn't it interesting how politicians will say, well, we're doing this because it's the right thing to do. So there's an appeal to some sort of morality, and then you sort of, you know, the politician is then hoping that you don't actually start unpicking that and saying, well, on what basis? But yes, we have this, and could that be, like the worship thing. Could that be one of the things that distinguishes us from animals? Do animals have a conscience? Yes.
You put image of God on the side and say this is sign.
not
does that mean because the image of God is included in all these things, or vice versa?
I think that's an excellent question. We will return to it. Yes. Right. Jesus. 27 minutes. Yes, good. The answer is Jesus. And the interesting thing is, it really is. We will come back to that, to him. Yes. Any other thoughts? I'm going to play you a song now. You happy with that? Yeah, I like listening to songs. We have the technology. It's remarkable. Here it is. It only came out about a couple of months ago. What did you make of that? A load of old cobblers? You sound confused, brother.
He needs a hug?
Exactly. And did you notice how in the final chorus, actually, he blurs where the subject is, where how the sentence is structured. So I, and so on. Yep. Any other thoughts? Yep. Yes. Very interesting. Yep. Mm-hmm. Great. Yep. Any other thoughts? Gungor is a husband and wife team. Gungor is their surname. They're a couple from the States, and they've produced a few albums. They now help pastor a church. And we can talk about this later if you want, because it does touch on this. But one of the things that's part of my own testimony is that I've been dealing with depression for the last 10 years, sometimes very acutely. And their music, which I only discovered some months ago, actually, I found sometimes pretty much the only Christian music I can cope with listening to, because they plumb the depths and really try to work out how to hold on to what they believe. I find them very stimulating and thought-provoking as well as heartwarming at the same time. So they definitely merit following up. But I think this is interesting because actually, in its different ways, this touches on all the things we've already talked about. Whether or not we are just animals, or is there something more? Are we sort of somehow spiritual? there is an ambiguity about the you. Now, I, as a Christian, naturally assume that he's addressing God, and I think he probably is. But it could be, am I addressing another person? Is it possible to have a kind of interaction, a relationship with another person? So who's seen The Matrix, the film The Matrix? It's now sort of rather old hat. but you know the premise that basically the world is a completely artificial construct by computers that are basically farming energy from human beings that are in these weird pods. And to pacify human beings, they've created this entire sort of cosmos, if you like, that is fed into their brains. And so everything is false. Everything that you see and sense is not reality. And so you can't actually relate to anybody else properly because you're stuck in this sort of pod. So there's a sense in which actually what I am and who I am impacts who you might be, and whether or not we can really connect. Can I actually really understand you? And that question actually is really important, because if I can't really understand you or anybody, it really throws up the possibility that nobody can really understand me. And that's actually a very frightening thought. Now, what I think is important about this is that this shows that all of this stuff, yes, it might be important, it might be dangerous, but that is a cry of the soul. This is an intensely personal problem. This is not highfalutin philosophizing in an ivory tower. This actually gets to the heart of my existence. How do I fit? How do I relate? Where am I going? Who do I belong to? Am I okay? It's really important. And you know, some of those sort of nouns there are a bit absurd, you might think. You know, I'm an alien. But then, of course, am I? I mean, there are some who will say that we're ruled by lizards, and the Queen and Obama and Putin, they're all reptiles. Yes, well, anyway. I hope you see not just the importance, but actually the pain of this question. And I think this generation, or maybe the last 40, 50 years, in the West particularly, is facing this question in the most uncertain and terrifying way. Because all the kind of inherited certainties or assumptions have just been eroded. And we can think about why that might be if you want later. But I hope that puts into some perspective, you know, from a sort of personal as well as a pastoral point of view, why actually getting some of these theological principles right is really significant. It affects how we live. So, you know, I'm sure you don't need defending the whole principle that theology is about everyday life. It's not sort of completely divorced from reality. But does anybody have any questions or thoughts or comments on that so far? No? Oh, yeah, sorry, yep. Right. I couldn't agree more. And thank you very much for saying that. I was having a long conversation with a lass yesterday who has just been afflicted with the whole business of deliberate self-harm and cutting. And not only that, compounded with sort of going from one abusive relationship to another, knowing full well that they'll be abusive, and that's part of the DSH, the deliberate self-harm. And it comes down to the bare bones identity issue, and that I am not worth more than this. This is what I deserve. This is who I am. And this is just the way it is. So nothing's going to change. So I'll just carry on. And, you know, again, all kinds of different, really deep, sort of hardcore pastoral problems so often come down to this. And it, you know, might have resulted from difficult things in parents or families or whatever it is. But it's amazing how often actually I find myself talking about identity issues. And of course, identity politics is very, very big now, and I would argue that actually the same issues get to the heart of issues of gender and sexuality in identity politics, as well as race. So it's very, very important indeed. What I'm going to do is I'm going to put up, and I sort of developed this more in a little book, which is available for a small fee. But I sort of came up with a few sort of coat hooks, if you like. And I want us just to think about the different elements. In other words, different sort of reductionisms of what it means to be human, a biological computer, that is, not... And just think about the limits, but also the appeal and justification, not justification, the grounds for thinking that this is who we are as human beings. So the four here are mind, ape, tool, computer, biological computer. And there are probably others that we could have thought about, but let's just take these four just to get us thinking. Just in terms of where they sort of fit and where they are too reductionistic, too nothing buttery, or don't go far enough. Okay, so do you want to just chat with your neighbor for a moment or two and pick one of those and see how you get on? Is everyone clear? Talk about these models for what a human being is. Talk about the pros and cons of using these reductionist things, ideas, concepts, nouns, metaphors, whatever. Things, bits and bobs. Oh, okay. No problem. Okay, obviously not going to exhaust or even scrape the surface of each of these. I start with mind. And you might think, hang on, why start there? Well, of course, famously, Descartes tried to find the irreducible minimum of our existence, the cogito ergo sum. I think, therefore, I am. And it's ingenious. I mean, you know, that is quite brilliant because, you know, you're conscious of this thought process. If I don't exist and yet I'm thinking, then what on earth is going on? he's really onto something. But it opened some trajectories that certainly he didn't foresee nor would have wanted. But in some ways, that is one of the sort of roots, you can't necessarily call it a cause as such, but the roots of Western individualism. I wonder if you can see why. What are the... Is anyone who tackled mind as a metaphor for being human, any thoughts, the pros, the cons? Or did you avoid that like the plague? Fair enough. Yes? Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay. So it certainly causes you questions about your physicality and where there can't be a connection because that's your essence. But then one of the big problems is that when, for instance, you start perhaps losing your memory and you have something like Alzheimer's and other related illnesses, if you are just a mind and you begin to lose that, say like Iris Murdoch, who was one of the geniuses of her generation, and then ends up watching Teletubbies, has she lost her humanness? Raises big questions there. Any other comments or thoughts? As a man think, okay, so there's a correlation perhaps there. But it's certainly not everything that the Bible says, and it's certainly not everything we want to say.
Just because he's lost his mind, it doesn't mean, you can treat him less than a human. He's still a human, created in God's image.
Right, so now these are our assumptions. I quite agree, and I am a Christian, I believe the Bible. I think one of the things, the sort of agendas I have today is... We are living in a culture for which that concept is absurd, and we're trying to sort of push to their logical conclusions some of the assumptions that we face around us. Say in Parliament a debate on euthanasia or whatever, trying to say, well, we're in the image of God. That's just going to cut no mustard at all. I'm not saying we shouldn't talk about that, but I'm just saying we've got to do more to try and expose and provide a better alternative. Do you see what I mean? So I completely agree. Yeah. Sure. Everything. Different things about everything. Right. Mm-hmm. Yep. So let's take a really gruesome example. You look at some of the propaganda in the 1930s about Jewish people. One of the things that would often be said is they think differently from us. I want to talk about that kind of language in a bit. Yeah. Yep. 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 Exactly. So the degenerative illness, I think, this is the front line of this problem. And so you get that horrible word that gets used vegetable, a human vegetable. You've heard that?
Yes.
Terrifying. Yeah. Yeah. Let alone any child, speaking as a parent. Yeah. Yep. 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 So, and the key word there is potential, isn't it? That matters in the debate. Yep. Yep. Yes. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. And you have the fallacy that if you don't have a word for something, you can't express it, which actually is nonsense. The human mind is capable of finding all kinds of circumlocutions and ways around. So just because you don't have a word for snow doesn't mean so you can't talk about snow. You probably just have to use 20 words instead of one, that's all. But people get rather absurd about language and linguistics. So anyway, I'm going to get carried away if I care on that. The other thing I want to say, though, about this as a reductionism is, and the thing that interests me about this is the fact that it does have some kind of causal or sort of root importance for the issue of individualism, because you see, if I think, therefore I am, I think, I have no idea whether you're thinking. I mean, you don't, you may well be thinking, but actually we are completely isolated from one another. We're silos, to use a horrible management speak. We're sort of independent little sort of cells around the place that operate, and we sort of bounce into each other every now and then, but we are cut off from each other. I'm doing all this thinking. Now, you could be just a computer program for all I know. So right at my root cause, I don't have any need for you. An extreme example, I don't know whether you saw, it wasn't a brilliant film in the end, sadly. It could have been, but it wasn't. With Johnny Depp, that film Transcendence, where basically this bloke has, a terminal illness, and he finds a way to import his entire mind into a computer. And therefore, he tries to take over the world by, taking all knowledge of everything through a search engine. It's a fascinating concept in a flawed film. But there you have this sense of, well, if all I am is a mind, then why not just put my brain into a computer so I can live forever, while there's electricity? but what is clear in the film is that they realize that, hang on, there's something really quite wrong with this. So there is something important to our humanness about being physical and having these bodies. C.S. Lewis tackled this in his space trilogy a bit, in Perelandra. And I can't remember the exact phrase. I should have written it down. But there's this guy who's who's basically trying to sort of refine what it means to be human, to sort of and to escape the confines of this sort of this cage. Because actually, when you think about it, this cage, this constraint, is profoundly embarrassing. And I'm not just talking about my body, even though it is. I'm very glad I'm clothed. And I'm incredibly glad that you are. But actually, our bodies are really embarrassing. I mean, pretty much everything they do, pretty much all their functions are pretty yucky and ugh, let alone smelly and ugly and weird and bleh. And so it's not surprising that we, even the greatest athletes in history at their peak performance still cannot completely control their physicality, can they? And there are things that the body will do which will embarrass them. I'm not going to go into detail. You don't need me to do that. But bodies are embarrassing, and yet we can't escape from them. And actually, yet at the same time, there's something glorious. Does that work? Actually, it's nice to take this off anyway. Oh, is this working? Yeah. This is the floor show, the evening's entertainment. Did you just lean on the button or something? It wasn't your fault? No. Do you know, it's awful being the sound guy, isn't it? Because if something goes wrong, everyone goes... and these guys, it's really bad luck. The sound desk in All Souls is by the back door, so everybody knows where to find them and beat them up. If you're in a church and there's a sound guy, please be nice to them. They have a miserable life. Well, I wouldn't say... No, that's going a bit far. But anyway, where was I? They're quite glorious. Let's think about this business of apes. Okay, the 97 or whatever percent that we share genetically. What else do we share with apes? Opposable thumbs, which is very, very significant. The fact that we can do that is of profound... Some would say evolutionary, and I would certainly say zoological significance.
So do raccoons.
I didn't know that. The other thing I didn't know, I found out the other day, is that the male fruit bat lactates. Anyway, that's... but I didn't know that about raccoons. That's very cool. I don't know what our genetic similarity with a raccoon is. Do you know that? No.
No.
Okay. She lived in America. Anyway, so the opposable thumbs, that's significant. So we can manipulate things, we can do things as some apes can with their hands, which enables using tools and all kinds of fun things. So that's good. Yep. Anything else? Yep.
They have family groups.
So
they're very involved in each other.
Yep. Right. Yep. So I suppose if you wanted an umbrella word, the sort of the social element that we do seem to share, and you know, those who have studied the gorillas in the mist or whatever, they have actually quite sophisticated social relationships. I don't know whether you've ever seen, it's definitely worth hunting down on YouTube, Damien Aspinall from the Aspinall family, friends of Lord Lucan, but also those who ran the Aspinall Zoo, but very involved in conservation and with gorillas and various apes. And Damien Aspinall grew up on this farm, this zoo, and they have various apes that they were breeding in order to reintroduce them into the wild later. So it was a remarkable program that has been very effective on a small, inevitably small scale, but very effective. Anyway, there was one of these apes called Queeby, and as a sort of young boy and a teenager, Aspinall really got to know Queeby very well, and they would hang out a lot together. He returns to the jungles of Gabon in West Africa as an experiment about 5 or 6 years later to go and see Queeby again and to see what would happen. And of course, they are dangerous animals, there's no doubt about it. You don't mess, you take it very, very seriously and carefully. So they took lots of precautions and so on, but it is one of the most moving things I think I've ever watched. And they were both Aspinall and Queeby were recognized each other immediately, and Queeby, when it was time for them to go, they were on a sort of boat up this river, Queeby left his family and followed them down the river, shouting out to them, and when they stopped to camp one night, Queeby stayed on the other side of the river where they were. And, you know, 5 or 6 years later, he completely recognized him, and not only that, he introduced Aspinall to members of his family. It was overwhelming. I was welling up, but then I'm a bit of a softy. You thought, wow, there really is something here. There was a relationship there. You couldn't call it anything else. It was a relationship. And he remembered. He had a memory of this man. And could tell that it was the same guy, even though he was older. I mean, just quite look it up on YouTube. Damien Aspinall, Queeby, the name of the animal is K-W-I-B-I. Well, go on.
He fed him, cared for him, related well to him. He would associate all those things with him when he saw him again, and he was looking forward to having the same things.
So there's undoubtedly an element of that. And my dog loves me because I take her for walks every day, and loves Rachel because she will feed her, or whatever it is. So there's an element of that. But do we not then begin to transgress the nothing buttery? Is it, okay, that might be an element, but is it just that? I don't know. But yeah, it's an absolutely fair question. I think this is interesting on some current debates because you find people talking about their problems, we might call them their temptations. Certainly, they might call them their predispositions or inclinations in actually quite animal-like terms. Does anyone know what I'm talking about? Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. So again, it's not. We want to say that there are social elements. The question is, how much more is there to it? So, again, do you see? We're constantly hitting up against the wall of reductionism. This is going on, but is something more going on to our relationships, or even to an ape's, if they can be called relationships at all. But, yeah. Right. Yep. 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 Excellent. I mean, it's fascinating, isn't it? I sometimes, particularly on issues of sex, the sort of morality of sex and the practice of sex in all its myriad and not so wonderful forms, I sometimes wonder, you know, do people actually stop to think about the arguments they use to justify what they want to do? Are you really saying that you are no better than an animal in the wild who just has to satiate its own desires? Really? That seems to be the heart of it, isn't it? I'm made like this, I'm sexually attracted to X, therefore, what business is it of you? What right do you have to say anything? Just leave me be. Okay? Or not. Yeah.
A different tack on the language about being animal-like. Sometimes when people are guilty of a horrendous murder or whatever it might be, people say it's worse than an animal.
Yeah, bestial.
Mm. Hunger, whatever it might be, that drives something.
Yes.
An animal kind of thing. And Stott used to talk about human beings, dignified and degraded.
Mm. Dignified and degraded. Sorry. Yes. No. Anyways. Yep. Yeah. I completely agree. And I think the 20th century magnificently and horrifically proves both ends. I think we have been glorious in the 20th century and tragically cruel and malicious in the 20th century. I'm a complete sort of 20th century geek. I'm absolutely fascinated and appalled simultaneously by it. I think we need to stop for coffee. We will carry on in half an hour. Is that correct?